Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The year 2006 marks the 300th anniversary of the birth of America's oldest founding father, Benjamin Franklin. And appropriately, and not unexpectedly, the nation is well into a year-long celebration of this man who became an enduring and even mythic figure. Our guest this week, Gordon Wood, the author of The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin, will help us separate the man from the myth. Following that, Fiona Beattie will tell us about a traveling and virtual museum exhibit on Franklin. And Talking History regular Thomas Fleming will join us once again to tell us about another of our founding fathers, George Washington, and how he triumphed over the attacks of his critics early in the war for American independence. But first, let's take a look at a couple of recent articles in the news you may have missed, both of which have to do with the subject of our interview this week, Benjamin Franklin. As I just noted, the nation is celebrating the birth of Benjamin Franklin, and that includes the Bush White House, which on March 23rd hosted a party in recognition of the founding father. The president and first lady invited some 100 people for the tricentennial event that featured entertainment from Ben himself, or at least a Franklin reenactor, Ralph Archbold, who has portrayed the founding father over 16,000 times since 1973. In fact, Archbold was the official Franklin during the 200th anniversary of his death in 1990. Among the party's decorations were artifacts associated with Franklin, such as a copy of the U.S. Constitution with Franklin's handwritten annotations, a miniature portrait of Louis XVI, and an 18th-century tankard from which Franklin drank. And among the new books being published on the 300th anniversary of Franklin's birth is the quite novel, if you will, account of Franklin's medical legacy by Stanley Finger, a medical historian at Washington University in St. Louis. In Dr. Franklin's Medicine, Finger lists what he considers to be the sage's most notable contributions to the field of medicine, reminding us that Franklin had no formal training in the field, and for that matter, only 2 years of classroom education. What he learned about medicine, he learned not only from books, but also from observations and careful experiments. Among Franklin's many contributions to the field, according to Finger, are Franklin's founding of the first public charity hospital, as well as the first medical school in the colonies, in Philadelphia, his publication of data in support of inoculation against smallpox, then a novel and controversial treatment, his questioning the commonly held belief that the common cold was caused by wet clothing and damp air, suggesting that colds are transmitted from person to person, his invention of bifocals, of course, as well as a flexible urinary catheter, his identifying lead, commonly encountered in a number of occupations of the day, as a source of poisoning, his experimentation with electrical shocks in the treatment of paralysis, hysteria, and depression, his recommendations on the benefits of exercise, and his continual exposure of what he considered medical quackery. In a moment, more on our birthday boy, Benjamin Franklin, with our guest, Gordon Wood. This is Talking History. For someone who's often considered the quintessential American, the title of Gordon Wood's book, The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin, strikes a curious note. But what Wood explains in his conversation with Talking History's Fred Nielsen is how Franklin came to embody that character we now refer to as the American and to represent the American dream.
Benjamin Franklin had a long life as a man, and a most extraordinary life it was. But Franklin has had an even longer life as a symbol. After his death, Americans turned the man into a mythic figure, one who, more than any of the other founders, embodied the meaning of their nation, the dream that anyone who worked hard could get ahead. But life and myth are two different things. My guest, Gordon Wood, disentangles them in his latest book, The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. A professor of history at Brown University, Gordon Wood is the author of two earlier books central to an understanding of America's early national history. the creation of the American Republic, and the radicalism of the American Revolution, which received the Pulitzer Prize in 1992. Professor Wood, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You write in your book on Benjamin Franklin that in the 18th century, society, American society, was divided into two parts, a tiny elite of gentlemen at the top, and a much larger group of commoners. And you suggest that that basic social division overwhelmed most of the other divisions in society, even perhaps the division between masters and slaves. How did that system work, and where did Franklin fit into it?
Well, that horizontal line between gentlemen and commoners was the most conspicuous horizontal line, more conspicuous than that between free and enslaved, much to our amazement, I think. But Franklin was part of a what was called a middling group, artisans and yeoman farmers, market farmers, and others who were self-employed tradesmen began asserting themselves and began being called the middling sort, standing between the gentry elite, who essentially were people who did not have to work for a living and certainly not work with their hands, and the rest of the common people. And so you have the beginning of what we would later call, of course, the middle class. This went back at least to the 17th century, but by the 18th century, where Franklin was emerging in the 1720s, the middling sort were becoming increasingly important.
Is that an awkward position to be in? Franklin at one point speaks of mulatto gentlemen, people who are a mixture of things, but not quite all one thing.
What he's making fun of in that little piece were people who tried to become gentlemen when they weren't prepared for it. They didn't know Latin, they weren't educated properly, and yet they had enough wealth to ape the gentry, but didn't have the wherewithal, all of the other attributes that constituted a gentleman. And so he made fun of those people in one of his pieces, and when he decided to become a gentleman, he made sure he had all of the attributes he could have, including skill in several languages.
Most of the founding fathers, people like Washington and Jefferson, for example, would have belonged to that tiny elite from birth. Franklin is a bit of an exception to that. He comes from a large, rather poor family. They have no great means, certainly, and unlike most of the other founders, works as an artisan. He works with his hands to a degree that most of them don't.
Right. His father was a soap maker, one of the lowest of the artisan trades, and Franklin was supposed to follow in his father's footsteps, but he rejected that, and he was a great reader, of course, and he chose printing, becoming an apprentice to his brother, who was a printer.
Part of his life story, of course, is how terribly hard he works, but it does seem that his goal, at least at some point, is to become a gentleman who, among other things, doesn't have to work with his hands anymore.
Well, at some point, he became very wealthy. He became one of the wealthiest entrepreneurs in all of the northern parts of the colonies of North America. And I think at some point he decided, well, I think I've made enough money that I can retire from business, and which is what he did in 1748 at the age of 42. He retires and never, in a technical sense, never works a day again in his life. He became a gentleman and engaged in scientific activities and public service, which is what gentlemen were supposed to do. But as far as working in his print shop, no.
Was that a smooth transition for him?
I think it was fairly smooth. He had a coming-out portrait made. He bought two slaves. He moved from his apartments, which were over the shop, which is where most artisans tended to live when they the tradesmen, and he moved to a separate quarters. I think he found it fairly easy because he had so much money. He was really one of the wealthiest people in all of Philadelphia, even though not a gentleman. He was still a tradesman until that moment of transition.
It's interesting that upon his retirement from work, his transformation into a gentleman, what seems to attract him is public service. He doesn't continue being a businessman, acquiring more money. He doesn't pursue, in a wholehearted way, his scientific endeavors, which made his fame. What was the appeal of public service to him?
Well, he thought that public service should be the main preoccupation of a gentleman. He did dabble in science, but of course his dabbling was more than dabbling. He made fundamental contributions to the understanding of electricity. But as he said to a fellow scientist and public official, Colden, who lived in New York, he said, look, even if Newton had any talent for public service, he should have left his scientific career and become a public servant. He felt that public service trumped all other activities and that a gentleman should engage in serving the general public.
This is a very 18th century idea, isn't it? The
yes.
Notion that one should be virtuous and serve the public?
Right. He was certainly fulfilling the ideals of the 18th century, that your contribution to government and to the community at large trumped all other activities.
it carries over even into his participation in the Constitutional Convention in 1787. There's the aging Franklin suggesting that executive officials in this new national government not be paid.
That's right. He had made this amazing proposal, one of two major ones he made in the convention, and that all members of the executive branch from the president on down should serve without pay. Now, there was a long period of silence when he made this, and it was, as Madison, who took the notes, said, it was tabled to avoid a vote, more out of deference to the old man than to the practicality of it, of the scheme. They took no vote on it because it would have been embarrassing to Franklin. It would have been so heavily defeated.
Your book on Franklin is entitled The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin, and part of the story of his Americanization is his becoming something other than the British loyalist that he long was. He was, for much of his life, a loyal subject of the king. We find him at one point trying to urge that Pennsylvania, his home colony, be turned into a royal colony. This is a man who's a long way from the 1760s advocating independence.
Yes, he was devoted to the British Empire, which he thought was the greatest phenomenon of the 18th century, which it was, the growth of the British Empire. This little island on the northwest corner of Europe coming to dominate the world as no state had since Rome. So he was very much taken with that, and he thought that this transatlantic empire would be a place where he could find fulfillment in public service. And he remained loyal to the empire longer than any of the other founders. He really tried to hold the colonies and the mother country together till the last moment, actually.
There's several times when we find him totally out of step with his fellow Americans, partly because I suppose he's in England and unaware of what's transpiring there, but we find Franklin endorsing the Stamp Act, for example, which tears the colonies apart.
Well, actually, he opposed it, as most, as all the agents who were over there, lobbyists. But when it was inevitable and was passed, he said, well, empires cost money, we've got to follow the law, and he misread popular sentiment in America and acquired the stamp agency for his friend John Hughes in Philadelphia, and almost cost Hughes his life, because mobs and riots threatened all of the stamp agents, forced them to resign, and not a single stamp was ever issued in America. Franklin just simply misjudged popular sentiment back home. He, of course, was abroad for most of his adult life. He left for England in 1757, came back for a couple of years to look after his post office in the mid-60s, but then remained until 1775. So from 1757, except for about 18 months, to 1775, the very eve of the Revolution, he was abroad living in London.
There's an aspect of Franklin that you bring out in your book that I'm not quite sure how to describe it. Charming, maybe even naive, in a sense. Over and over again, we find Franklin believing that people can be reasonable. If they would just sit down with cool heads, most of these problems could be resolved.
That's right. He had what I guess we would call an elitist view of politics. He thought that a few reasonable men sitting down in a chamber could solve the problems. He really didn't understand the emotions and the structural problems that lay behind the imperial crisis. And he said that he thought the whole thing could have been solved by two men in a half an hour. He could not have been more wrong about that.
So what turns this king's loyal subject into an American patriot?
The British government in the end turn on him because they think he's an American agent. And it has to do with the affair of the Hutchinson letters, a complicated affair where he revealed some letters that had been written by Thomas Hutchinson, who was royal governor of Massachusetts. And Franklin has the naive idea that if he can blame Hutchinson, who is a native American, for the crisis, then the ministry back in London will be absolved of responsibility. Then Franklin, together with Lord Dartmouth, who had taken over the American department, the executive department in the responsible for American affairs, that he and Dartmouth could solve the whole problem. Well, and instead that backfires, and the crown turns on him with a vengeance, attacks him in what was called the cockpit, which was a chamber in Whitehall, viciously, an hour-long diatribe by the Solicitor General against Franklin. So vicious, in fact, that the London papers could not publish all of what was said. And from that moment on, Franklin's fate in England is sealed, and he hangs on for another year or so, trying to hold the thing together, largely because William Pitt, or Lord Chatham, seeks his aid. But he leaves in March of 1775, just before he's to be arrested for having exposed these Hutchinson letters. He was accused of being a thief. And he escapes arrest, in a sense, in 1775, and comes back to America a flaming patriot, bitterly antagonistic to the crown and to everything that he's believed in up to that moment.
The Declaration of Independence is written in 1776. Franklin is 70 years old. He's past retirement, we might think.
Right.
And yet, you write in your book that if Washington was indispensable to the success of the Revolution in America, Franklin, this 70-year-old man, becomes indispensable to its success abroad. He becomes American minister to France.
Right. He's sent over as an agent at the end of 1776 and remains there until 1785, bringing the French into the war on behalf of the American cause, which was no easy task because this was a monarchy, for example, supporting a republic in a world of monarchies, and it was a dangerous business. The most important thing he did, of course, was to extract loan after loan from an increasingly impoverished French government to the point where the French bankrupted themselves and prepared the way for their own French Revolution. But Franklin was indispensable. He had international standing and was celebrated by the French, and no one else could have done what he did. The French aristocracy, the French court, loved him.
There's a kind of curious inverse relationship between French attitudes toward Franklin and American attitudes. The more the French love him, the more, at least some Americans, are suspicious of him.
Exactly. John Adams and the Lee family were very suspicious of Franklin. They thought he was in the pocket of the French, and that, in a sense, because he spent so many years in France, that he had gone native, so to speak, that he was much more enamored of the French than he was of his own countrymen. And they became increasingly suspicious of him, and that accounts for the hostility that he felt when he returned to America in 1785. He was not welcomed by the Congress. He was treated rather shabbily by the Continental Congress, and really quite angered and embittered by this treatment.
So the Americanization of Franklin has proceeded. He has moved from becoming a loyalist to the British crown to becoming an arch-revolutionary, and yet the embrace of Franklin by America is still remarkably tepid. You note that after his death, while the French are commemorating him, Americans are very slow to do so.
That's right. He had only one eulogy, and that was given by his inveterate enemy, William Smith of Philadelphia, who was assigned the task by the American Philosophical Society and was really reluctant to do it. It was only because of French pressure. The French kept sending their eulogies back to America, and it became embarrassing that the Americans had given none. I mean, this is in contrast to Washington. When he died, he had at least 400 eulogies printed, never mind all that were never printed. Franklin gets one. That gives you some idea of his standing at the moment of his death in 1790. Franklin's reputation gets enhanced after his death with the publication of his autobiography. It's then that artisans and other businessmen, essentially, is what they were, tradesmen who were employers and so on, pick up Franklin and use him as the founder that can give them some standing in the world. Franklin stood for their rise, and it's the rise of capitalism, if you will, in the early 19th century that makes Franklin the hero that he became.
That's, in a sense, the point where your book is leading. The emergence of Franklin as symbol, the embodiment of certain aspects of the American character. How valid is that mythic Franklin?
Well, I think it's valid in the sense that he was certainly a product of social mobility. He came from the lowest kind of circumstances, an artisan family, one of 15 children, I think, and very poor, and rises to being the most well-known American, if not the most well-known person in the whole 18th century European world. Everybody knew Franklin, largely because of his scientific discoveries. In other words, those scientific discoveries, if there'd been Nobel Prizes in the 18th century, he would have been a candidate for one. He wasn't just a tinkerer, a kind of early version of Thomas Edison. No, he made fundamental contributions to science. But his real fame comes after his death, with the publication of his autobiography, which shows a man coming from nothing to the top of the world. And I think that story made people of the early 19th century feel that anything could happen in America, that you could come from the smallest, lowest levels of the society and make it. And that, I think, is what he stood for. Of course, imaginative writers, Poe and Twain and Melville, all disliked Franklin's image because they don't like money-making and capitalism. And so Franklin did not get a good reputation among imaginative writers. But for most Americans, he stood for, I think, social mobility and the ability of ordinary people to make it. Of course, he was a genius, and that helped a lot.
It would help me too, I think. Well, Professor Wood, thank you so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Gordon Wood, the author of The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin.
Monsieur le Docteur, what was your greatest invention?
Oui, Monsieur. What was it?
Tell us about it, Grandfather.
Well, Benny, one dark night, a rainy one, accounts for some lightning and thunder. I was puttering in my laboratory for an idea, a new and a brainy one. Now, what did the world really need? What contraption for use and for free? Well, I made a working model the following day, and I called it the Public Me.
Oh, tell us some more about it.
The left hand's a poker for stirring up trouble. The right hand's a pipe for blowing a bubble. The neck is made of curtain rods. It's certainly never been
Temple.
I invented myself out of odds and ends.
Polymath and Founding Father. That's how Talking History's Fiona Beatty describes Benjamin Franklin in reviewing a new traveling and virtual museum on the Founding Father. She joins us now to tell us about that exhibit.
Benjamin Franklin, Polymath and Founding Father. The man whose legend grows larger in American memory with the passage of time is honored in 2006 with a year-long celebration to mark the 300th anniversary of his birth. Established by an act of Congress in 2002, the Benjamin Franklin Tercentenary has created a traveling exhibit, Benjamin Franklin, In Search of a Better World, and a virtual exhibit of the same title to enhance our understanding of the American icon. Divided into six sections, the virtual exhibit explores the life of Benjamin Franklin thematically, beginning with the formation of his character, his lust for learning, and voracious reading habits, and ending with Franklin, the elder statesman, at the Constitutional Convention. In his later years as president of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, Franklin took a strong stand against slavery. One learns, too, that although his autobiography is unfinished, it apparently enjoys a reputation as being the most widely published memoir in history and has never gone out of print. Throughout the exhibit, interesting snippets of information broaden one's understanding of the man, serving to demythologize him from icon to polymath. Digitized images and audio augment the explanatory text throughout, and quotes from Franklin's Paul Richards Almanac set the stage for each section. Visitors gain insight into Benjamin Franklin, learning that he was very much at the hub of communications in the New World, investing in paper mills, financing a German language printing office, as well as running his own printing press and writing. And just who or what was Silence Do-Good? I leave it up to you to find out at www.benfranklin.300.org.
And finally, Talking History regular Thomas Fleming concludes this week's show by telling us how another of our founding fathers, George Washington, countered his critics during the War for American Independence by applying to the art of politics some critical lessons he'd learned about fighting a war.
Washington's secret victory at Valley Forge. Abusing our leaders has been an American sport for a long time. Not many people realize it began with George Washington, well before he became president. At Valley Forge, he was showered with vitriolic denunciations by critics in Congress and the upper ranks of the American Army. Today, Valley Forge is a national shrine. In 1777 and 1778, it looked more like a black hole in which the American Revolution was about to disappear. Officers were resigning in droves, and as many as 50 men deserted in a single day. When the army ran out of food, whole regiments shouted, "No meat, no soldier!" The British army was luxuriating before warm fires in Philadelphia, which they had captured in late September 1777. According to the critics, it was all General Washington's fault. Many people compared Washington to General Horatio Gates, the victor in the 1777 Battle of Saratoga. I have heard several officers who have served under General Gates compare his army to a well-regulated family, wrote one ex-congressman and signer of the Declaration of Independence. The same gentlemen have compared General Washington's imitation of an army to an unformed mob. General Gates did everything in his power to encourage these admirers. He left no doubt that he was ready and willing to replace Washington as commander-in-chief. When Congress dispatched a 5-man investigating committee to Valley Forge, James Lovell assured Samuel Adams that they would wrap a demigod over the knuckles. Patrick Henry, the governor of Virginia, received an anonymous letter smearing Washington. A similar letter was left on the stairs outside Congress's chamber. Washington's abusers assumed he would consider it beneath his dignity to answer these assaults. They expected the humiliated general to resign his commission and go home to Mount Vernon. Instead, Washington stunned his opponents by fighting back. When one of his generals reported a critic was bragging about an insulting comment on Washington's leadership he had sent to Horatio Gates, Washington sent the man a blunt inquiry, asking if it were true. The critic and General Gates grew panicky. When the 5-man committee arrived at Valley Forge expecting whines and complaints, Washington presented them with a masterful 16,000-word report on the Army's problems. Late one night, Washington turned to the committee chairman and said, "Congress does not trust me. I cannot go on thus." The shaken chairman and the rest of the committee soon became Washington's allies. In little more than 2 months, General Washington had his critics on the run. The carping congressmen rushed to deny that they had ever harbored a negative thought about that great and good man, George Washington. General Gates wrote Washington a hypocritical letter claiming he never dreamt of replacing him. How did this miracle take place? The man from Mount Vernon applied to the art of politics some crucial lessons he'd already learned about fighting a war. He seized the initiative and threw his enemies on the defensive. Best of all, when the hugger-mugger ended, Washington forgave his vanquished foes and re-enlisted them in the struggle for American liberty. It is a leadership style that today's politicians might well ponder.
You've been listening to Thomas Fleming, the author of Washington's Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge, published by Smithsonian Books. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.